forget frequently asked questions.
Common sense, common knowledge, or Google.
How about advice from a real genius? 95% of people in any profession are good enough to be qualified and licensed. 5%
go above and beyond.
They become very good at what they do, but only
0.1%.
are real geniuses. Richard Jacobs has made it his life's mission to find them for you. He hunts down and interviews geniuses in every field. Sleep science, cancer, stem cells, ketogenic diets, and more. Here come the geniuses. This is the Finding Genius Podcast
with Richard Jacobs.
Hello, this is Richard Jacobs with the Finding Genius Podcast, now part of the Finding Genius Foundation. My guest today is Martin Kolldor. He was a professor. He's an epidemiologist. We're going to talk about issues surrounding the COVID pandemic, a better way that things could have been done instead of the pathetically horrible way that they were done. We're going to discuss other issues like that. So welcome, Martin. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It's a great pleasure.
If you would tell me a bit about your background, and you know, then we'll go into COVID.
Well, I was born and raised in Sweden. I got my PhD at Cornell University and eventually ended up as an epidemiologist and a biostatistician at the faculty of Harvard University. I was a professor of medicine. And when the pandemic started 4 years ago, it was kind of a shock because I work with infectious disease outbreaks. And the approach that this country took to it was contrary to all the basic principles of public health.
Were you in Sweden at the time, or you were in the U.S. for a long time?
No, I was in the U.S. working at Harvard at the medical school there.
Oh, but you probably have contacts back at home. And I guess supposedly Sweden was the one country that, you know, for a while didn't lock down and it was demonizing the news and then no one said a word about it. Did you talk to people back home during COVID and did you get any interesting insights?
Yes, I did. And actually, I participated in the COVID debate in Sweden also. I was afraid that Sweden would buckle down under the international pressure and start locking down also. So I wrote some articles, some op-eds in the major daily newspapers there defending the Swedish strategy when they were attacked by others. Of course, now we know after 4 years, Sweden has the lowest excess mortality among major Western European countries. So that's, you compare the mortality during the pandemic with what would be expected based on the mortality in the previous 3 or 5 years. So that combines both COVID deaths, where Sweden did well, and deaths from the collateral public health damage on cardiovascular disease, cancer, mental health, and so on. So Sweden did well because COVID was, it did good with COVID, and it did excellent avoiding all the collateral damage.
No, that's great. So when COVID first started, what did you notice from colleagues, from the university, from the news, from, you know, what were your thoughts initially in the first few weeks of it?
Well, I was afraid for maybe 10 or 20 minutes, because as soon as the pandemic hit northern Italy and Iran, which were the two first outbreaks, major outbreaks outside of China, it was clear that this virus was going to spread to the whole world. It will arrive sooner or later. And there was nothing we could do that, just like with influenza. There's no way to stop it. So the question was then, is how dangerous is this? And like any parent, I'm much more concerned about well-being of my children than myself. So I looked up at the data from Wuhan, and this was before there was any single death in the US. And from the Wuhan data, it was clear that the people who died was the old people. So I did some calculations, epidemiological calculations, concluded that while anybody can get infected, the risk of dying from COVID, there's more than 1,000-fold higher among the old versus the young. So this is really a disease of the old. So based on the principles of public health, we had to do as much as we could to protect older people while letting children go to school and letting young people live fairly normal lives and sort of keep society afloat, because somebody has to do that also. We can't just all go and sit at home, because then we won't have anything to eat and so on.
Right. So when did things start to turn crazy? Like, I can't believe they're doing this. This is ridiculous.
That was mid-April of 2020. So, for example, on March 10, my university, Harvard, decided to close down and go to online teaching without any push from the government at that time. And that sort of set the stage for the rest of the country with other schools and universities closing as well. And that was not a good thing. It basically, students and children are not at high risk. And it basically sent the university students back home to their older parents to infect them instead of infecting other their own age who were also at low risk. So it sort of had the opposite effect. It didn't protect people. It actually increased the risk for older people.
Were you contacted by news and did they ask for your professional opinion, or were you and other epidemiologists ignored?
So I was not. I tried to write articles to point out this age difference and how we should focus on protecting the older people, but I was unable to publish in the US. I was able to do it in Sweden in the major newspapers, but not in the US. Not until August of 2020, I tried to point out that Sweden had kept the schools open and none of the children died, and of the 1.1 million children died, and there was only a few hospitalizations and teachers were no higher risk than others. So I tried to sort of point that out to make sure that Swedish schools could open here in the US. But that was also difficult. I tried on Twitter, but I was put on the trans blacklist by Twitter. And then finally in August, I was able to publish something in CNN about the Swedish school open and that would be the best thing to do. But in CNN Espanol, CNN English didn't want it. But I know how to speak, I write Spanish. So I was able to publish the CNN Espanol.
How early did you start thinking something is wrong here? This response doesn't make sense.
In March of 2020, it was already when Harvard closed down. And then about a week later, the federal government, the White House, was declaring that we're going to lock down for 2 weeks. And then, of course, that was extended more. So, yeah, it was clear in March to any thinking or any knowledgeable infectious disease epidemiologist that this was the wrong way to go, because there would be so much collateral harm. And the benefit, it will postpone things a little bit, but in the long run, there will be no benefits from the lockdowns.
So I'm sure, you know, you were listening to Fauci and the BS that he was spewing. I'm putting words in your mouth, though. Like, what did you see when you started to see, like, Fauci talk on TV or, you know, the CDC or these different entities? What was your thought based on what they were saying and their recommendations?
Well, they were ignoring principles of public health. But also, I mean, Anthony Fauci, he's a lab scientist. He's not a public health scientist, so he doesn't understand public health very well. The same with the NIH director, Francis Collins, is also a lab scientist. He's a geneticist. So they did not understand public health. And I think some months ago, Francis Collins acknowledged that they had ignored all the collateral damage. And one principle of public health is you can't just focus on one disease. You have to consider what consequences on other things, like cancer or cardiovascular disease or diabetes or mental health. They just focused completely on COVID, and they didn't even do that right, because we didn't protect older people the way we should have, and people died because of that. At the same time, children, for example, was harmed by keeping the school closed, and we have seen that the test results for kids went down, plummeted. And of course, school is not only important for test results, but also for the social interaction that children have to learn to interact with others their own age.
So what did you think when, again, things became ridiculous and then they continued? Like, what were you thinking? Did you realize what was wrong, or why? Like, why was this turning into something that had nothing to do with reality?
I don't still understand why things went so wrong. I understand why a lot of my colleagues kept quiet, because, well, some tried to speak up, but it wasn't able to, just like me in the beginning. So it took a long time before I was able to pick up. And that wasn't until October of 2020, where I could sort of get through the bubble. But I also understand that some people didn't even try, because Anthony Fauci sits on the biggest pile of infectious disease research money in the world. So if you want to be funded for your research, it's not a good idea to make him upset and contradict what he's saying. And that's kind of a flaw, that the same person is sitting on the purse of research money, who is also dictating what the policy should be without even understanding public health. So it was a complete mess up. But I don't know what his motivation was, why he didn't want to listen to people who actually knew something about public health, for example, who had different views than he did.
Well, I think one big motivation is called Remdesivir, and the monies from that, and other motivations were royalties from, you know, medicines or vaccines or things like that derived from fighting COVID. That I think those are maybe multi-million or multi-billion dollar reasons why, but that's just my guess.
Yeah, and there's a problem between academia and pharmaceutical industry, that a lot of people doing epidemiological research get funding from pharmaceutical companies in one way or another. So I have never accepted any funding from pharmaceutical industry, because I work on vaccine and drug safety, and I think that would be a conflict of interest if I make money from the pharmaceutical companies at the same time as I'm evaluating their products in terms of adverse reactions. My colleague, Jay Balacharya, who is the co-author for the Great Barrier Declaration, where we, in October 2020, argued for focus protection, he hasn't taken any pharmaceutical money either. So maybe that makes a difference.
What about when this, you know, it took a few months. I was in Texas here, so it was about June of 2020. Then they started talking about masks all of a sudden. What did you think of the mask requirements and all of a sudden the whole world doing that? Was that just another layer of insanity on top of it, or what were your thoughts about that?
Before we continue, I've been personally funding the Finding Genius podcast for 4.5 years now, which has led to 2,700 plus interviews of clinicians, researchers, scientists, CEOs, and other amazing people who are working to advance science and improve our lives and our world. Even though this podcast gets 100,000 plus downloads a month, we need your help to reach hundreds of thousands more worldwide. Please visit findinggeniuspodcast.com and click on Support Us. We have 3 levels of membership from $10 to $49 a month, including perks such as the ability to see ahead in our interview calendar and ask questions of upcoming guests, transcripts of podcasts you're interested in, the ability to request specific topics or guests, and more. Visit findinggeniuspodcast.com and click Support Us today. Now, back to the show.
No, it was. Thinking as a scientist, we knew from studies before the pandemic that masks were not doing much good for like influenza. So you wouldn't expect it to do much good for COVID either. But it took some time before we had some actually randomized trials on it. And there were two, one in Denmark, that randomized people to wear a mask or not and didn't show any benefit. And then there was another one. It was kind of a neat one because instead of randomizing individuals, they randomized villages. And some villages, people were wearing masks. In others, they were not. So then you can evaluate not only the protection to the mask wearer, but also if they protect other people. And they found that there was they reduced transmission between something between 0 and 18%. So either not at all or minuscule. So masks is not a good protection against COVID, but it's a problem when Anthony Fauci and others sort of go out there and give people a false sense of security from wearing a mask. So if you're 75 years old, during the height of the pandemic, you shouldn't go to a crowded restaurant. That's not a good idea if you are, because you are in a high risk group. So to tell people, okay, wear a mask, and if other people wear a mask, you'll be safe. Well, that gives a false sense of security. So then people will actually do things they shouldn't do, like going to a crowded place and maybe get infected and some of them will die because people were told that they were sort of fooled into thinking that they would be safe because of wearing a mask. So that was a public health message that was a disaster because they were claiming that something would protect people that it wouldn't. And you never should do that in public health.
There's still people that are wearing masks in their cars alone. And 4 years later, there's still, it's not a lot, but it's just amazing to me. And everyone's still, they've talked about bringing it back and they just ignore reality. They still are saying it's useful and protect you and all that. It hasn't stopped. It's amazing.
It is because I don't understand why any scientist would argue for it because the data is very clear that it doesn't provide any good protection.
What about when they started saying, we need to wait for a vaccine, that the vaccine is the only thing that'll save us? And, you know, the beginning of the whole vaccine thing, what was that like in your mind? And what did you see there?
Well, I think it was good that they tried hard to come up with a vaccine. That was a good thing. And it started very early. So that's a good thing, unlike some of the drugs where I think NIH and NIAID messed up by not running all the studies they should have done. But for vaccine, they did. So that was a good thing. Now, the problem with vaccines or the trials is they were not designed properly. They were designed and they showed that there's a 95% efficacy against symptomatic COVID. But that's not really what we care about. We care about the deaths. So they should have recruited older people because they recruited young people and they survived whether they got the vaccine or not. So we don't know if it prevented deaths. So they should have required older people to see if it actually prevented mortality. And I think it prevented mortality in older people in 2021, but it's not at all clear to me whether in children or young adults, whether there was more benefits or harm from these vaccines. And we know that the benefits was very small because the risk of dying is small. But yeah, not at all clear that there was a benefit that was bigger than the harms from the vaccine. And we know there were some harms like myocarditis, for example, which is inflammation of the heart. And also the criticism.
It was tons of, right, there's data that was ignored, removed, et cetera. They stopped counting deaths. I saw because I was tracking VAERS, and for at least a year, I believe it was around 2021, 2022, they just stopped counting deaths because the number just stayed static. It didn't increase at all.
The other very strange thing, they had this vaccine mandate, and there are many reasons not to have that, but they were even mandating the vaccine for people who had COVID, who had the infection immunity.
What proper protocol, if the vaccine actually worked, what would have been the proper protocol?
Well, suppose it was a this is not a perfect vaccine by any means, but suppose it was. Suppose it had 100% efficacy against death and no side effect. It has side effects and it's not 100% efficacy, and the efficacy wanes fairly quickly. But suppose it was perfect, then it would be highly unethical to mandate vaccines to people who already are immune because there was a shortage of vaccines. So why should I take the vaccine then who had COVID before the vaccine was available, while my 87-year-old neighbor couldn't get the vaccine yet? That's unethical for women to take the vaccine when she needed it much better. Older people in South America or Africa or Asia, for example. So vaccine mandates are very unethical for that reason alone. There are also other reasons like self-determination of and informed consent and those things, which are very, very important. But for this reason alone, vaccine mandates are unethical. And if anybody who claims to be pro-vaccine should be against vaccine mandates for this reason.
And it got even crazier where they said there's a pandemic of the unvaccinated. And they were starting to demonize people that refused it. And, you know, what were your thoughts as the whole vaccine debacle went on?
Well, there was a pandemic both among the vaccinated and the unvaccinated, because even if you got vaccinated, you would eventually get COVID. So when CDC was saying that if you get the vaccine, you will not be able to get, you won't get COVID, they were obviously wrong.
What do you think now? There had been the lockdowns, there had been the masks, there had been the vaccines, there had been the mandates. Like, at what point after a year and a half, 2 years of this, what were you feeling like? Like, what was the sum of your thoughts at that time after all this had happened?
Well, I'm kind of shocked how the scientific community and the public health community acted. I used to be very proud when people ask me what work I do. I say, I'm a scientist. I was very proud to say that, but I'm not really very proud about that anymore because I think the scientific community messed up. And not the rank and file scientists, because there are many really good scientists doing really good work, but in terms of the scientific leadership of like the heads of the funding agencies and CDC and universities and scientific journals, they messed up. And I think the trust in science and the trust in public health has plummeted for very good reasons.
So what was happening with your research? Like, were you able to do nothing for a year or two? Everything was COVID. There was no room for anything else. Like, what happened to your work during this time, you know, 2021, 22, 23?
Well, I was doing various work, a lot of COVID related, but I was doing other things. And my two areas of expertise is how to early detection of infectious disease outbreaks and how to monitor infectious disease outbreaks. So I was working on that. And my other area of expertise is surveillance of drugs and vaccines after they've been approved. So they're already on the market. So post-market drug and vaccine safety surveillance. So there was work with that also that was COVID related and other things.
It seems like the post-drug or post-vaccine data collection is just demonized and called anecdotal evidence. Is it even valued? I mean, like, it's crazy to me. You could have a clinical trial of like 30 people or 50 people and they consider that evidence. But let's say it's like Lipitor. You know, it's been taken by tens of millions of people at least for years and years and years. But all that's just anecdotal evidence. Forget it. You know, so what is this surveillance like? Was it even respected or was it demonized? Like, what was the political message around it?
No, so to do safety vaccine and drug safety surveillance is well recognized in the scientific community as an important thing to do. And we have systems to do it that I think are very good. For example, some years ago, maybe 15 years ago or so, there was a new measles vaccine, the measles, mumps, rubella, varicella vaccine with like four different diseases in one, or protection against four diseases in one needle. And it was approved by FDA. And then we find out a month later that there's an excess risk of febrile seizures from this vaccine when it's taken by one-year-olds. Five-year-olds can take it, no problem. So that was found out after about 25,000 doses. And then there was the change in recommendations so that younger kids are recommended to take the old vaccines and only the five-year-olds will get the new ones. So that's sort of the way it should work. The vaccine was approved. It was found out that there were some issues with it. And then you change the recommendations to who should get it and who shouldn't. So that's the system that we've had and that how we should operate. But that didn't work very well during COVID.
So you don't have to talk about this if you don't want to. It's totally up to you. But are you open to discussing what happened with Harvard? If not, it's fine.
Yeah, so I had COVID before the vaccine was available. And before that, I had argued with Harvard and others that they should not fire people who have had COVID. They should instead hire them. They should like hire nurses with COVID because they have superior immunity. So I wrote about that. And instead, what they did, they had nurses who in 2020 took care of COVID patients. Then they got infected. So they were home for a while and then go back to work and taking care of more COVID patients. But then in 2021, some bureaucrat at the Harvard hospitals decided, no, you need the vaccine. Doesn't matter that you already have superior immunity. You still need to take the vaccine. And since you don't want to get it, we'll fire you. So a lot of people was fired because of that. And I was one of them because I had COVID. And I also have an immune deficiency that's genetic called alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency. So I had to be very careful about the infections. And there was no data on this vaccine on me. So I didn't want to take the risk. I didn't need it because I already had immunity that was superior to getting the vaccine. So there was no medical reasons for me to do it. And it was unscientific and unethical. So then the Harvard Mass General Brigham Hospital, they fired me, and the medical school put me on leave for 2 years. And then when that ended, they got rid of me as well.
What happened next when you got fired?
I still have a good relationship with many of my scientific colleagues. So I'm still working on various research projects that I enjoy. But I'm sort of doing it now as an independent person instead of as part of a university.
So what are you working on right now, now that the job is ended?
I work on early detection of infectious disease outbreaks. That's not only important for pandemics, but also like foodborne disease outbreaks. If some restaurants are serving food that's contaminated with salmonella, we want to know it as soon as possible so we can sort of stop it. So that's sort of a daily regular activity that is important for state and local health department to engage in to sort of monitor it so that when there's a problem like that, it can be quickly taken care of. Get out and taken care of so that more people don't get sick. So I do that. And but more on the other front, I'm involved in with Dr. Scott Atlas and Dr. Jay Balasharia, both at Stanford. We're founding fellows of the Academy for Science and Freedom, which is a Hillsdale initiative. And the goal there is to reform how the scientific community operates in terms of publications, promotions, funding, and so on, to hopefully sort of restore things so that the scientific community can, to restore the scientific enterprise so that we can continue in the age of enlightenment. Otherwise, I think we have darkness ahead of us in terms of science.
What do you think now? Do you see like that politicization is growing and advancing into other fields? Or what are you seeing in science in the various different disciplines?
I think it's better in some places than worse in others. I think there's frustration among the rank and file scientists, how it operates. So I think it's ripe to make some reforms to make it work better.
I didn't ask you about this. The declaration that came out, the Great Barrington Declaration, did that have any teeth to it? Were you very aware of it? Like what was its role, if any?
So I was one of the three co-authors with Drs. Jay Balasharia and Drs. Sunetra Gupta, and it quickly, I think within a few weeks, it had already 600,000 co-signers, and now it's almost 1 million. So we argue there that we shouldn't lock down, we shouldn't close schools, that we should do a much better job protecting the older people, letting children and young people live normal lives. And I think it had an impact because before that, it was very hard. Anybody, me or somebody else trying to raise our voice was very hard because we were sensed to silence and, or in some case, sort of dismissed like, oh, this is only one person or this doesn't have the right credentials and so on. So it was very hard for people to sort of speak up and get through. So with the Great Barrington Declaration, there was three of us, so not just one person. And then we all had credentials working for a long time with infectious disease technology. And we were also from reasonably respected universities, Stanford, Harvard, and Oxford. So it became impossible for the lockdowners or the politicians or the media to ignore this. So I think we burst the bubble because they pretended that there was a scientific consensus for these lockdowns, which was never the case. And among my personal colleagues, the most people agree with me. So there was never a consensus. And I think the Great Barrington Declaration sort of popped that bubble, making it clear that there was no consensus. So we sort of ended the silencing period, and instead we entered the slandering period, because since they don't have public health arguments for lockdowns, the only two things they can do is either silence and censor, or they can do slander and smearing. So they started to do that. The head of the NIH, instead of encouraging like these discussions and debate, he asked for a devastating takedown and calling us fringe epidemiologists. And we were denounced by the WHO head, Tedros, in the parliament in the UK. So it was pretty rough attacks on us, but instead of debate. But I think it was actually good, because when the newspapers would write about it, they would have a link to it and people would get curious. So they would click on the link and read it for themselves. And people are smart. So I think that's why we got so many signatures, because it sort of spread like a wildfire at the time.
Do you think there'll be any apologies, or they can't apologize? They'll be devoured if they do, you know, the authorities, and like, what's going to happen here? You think just years are going to pass and then all of a sudden there'll be exposés on it, but it'll be 20 years too late? Or what do you think is going to happen with COVID? How is it going to age? Yeah.
I don't think there will be any apologies, unfortunately. There should be like a national commission, but I don't think there's going to be one. There is one in New Hampshire and one in Florida, but I don't think there will be a national one. I don't think they can do lockdowns again, because most people now realize what a disaster it was, and people are sort of more organized and among the public. So I think the public will prevent it to ever be this thing again. And in the long run, I hope that as a new generation of public health people come about, so that 40 years from now, I think they will look back and realize what a mess this was and what a disaster it was, because they were not the one responsible. So my hope is that the new generation will study the pandemic and understand the history and what went wrong.
Okay.
There will be another pandemic. It might be 5 years from now, or 20 years from now, or 50 years from now, but there will be another pandemic. So it's important that we get the history right.
True, yeah. So what's the best way for people to keep tabs on your work and to follow up? Where can they go now?
They can follow me on Twitter, Martin Kulldorff, and they can also connect with the Academy for Science and Freedom, the Hillsdale Initiative. So that's two ways to do it. I'm also on LinkedIn and a few other social media places.
Well, very good. Well, Martin, thank you for coming on the podcast and explaining calmly what you experienced and what your thoughts are. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
If you like this podcast, please click the link in the description to subscribe and review us on iTunes.
You've been listening to the Finding Genius podcast with Richard Jacobs. If you like what you hear, be sure to review and subscribe to the Finding Genius podcast on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. And want to be smarter than everybody else? Become a premium member at findinggeniuspodcast.com. This podcast is for information only. No advice of any kind is being given. Any action you take or don't take as a result of listening is your sole responsibility. Consult professionals when advice is needed.